This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Come on. We call it the place to be.
The place to be, yes.
The place to be.
Then I shall be.
Place to Be Nation, Scott Criscola and Justin Rosero. This is the Place to Be podcast.
It is contagious. It is the place to be, and we are live each and every Monday.
To do worse than Josh Richards.
Turn it up, see the money ain't a thing.
Flex the road, sign a check for your hoe. Jigga style is love, X and O. Save all your accolades, just the dough. My game is wide, all names aside. Trying to stay alive, 100,000 for the bracelet. Foolish ain't out of chain to strain your eye. Twin platinum gun, son, aim for the sky. Ice on my bullet, you die soon as I pull it. Willies wanna rub shoulders, your money too young. See me when it gets older, your bank account grow.
Place Be Nation, welcome to another great episode of the one and only Place Be Podcast. I am your co-host, Just Rosero. We're live here on this jam-packed Monday evening of Memorial Day. Scott Criscola, how are you?
Good evening, JR. Another Memorial Day that we are celebrating. Well, you don't really celebrate Memorial Day, but with you. Mm-hmm. Welcome to episode 490 of the longest running episodic motherfucking gold standard. The final decade begins before we hit five bills. So it's not going to be the next decade that we do 500, as you kept thinking, but believe it or not, we're actually right around the corner from it. So. Yes, it was an extended Memorial Day weekend, JR. Mm-hmm. It was good to see you, and on Saturday, of course, at the annual Rotella Fun and Games Cavalcade. Yep. Yes, FanFest. Yes.
I guess we should tell the story, right? Because I think it was one of the most epic roasts of all time. As you know, Matt Rotella is a fan favorite here. He'll probably be on the 500th episode, as he always is, mm-hmm. on the anniversaries, but... you know, a bit of a fan favorite, a bit of a punchline, obviously a gentleman, a man with a heart of gold, but easy, right? Easy to target. And for all of the shots that we've landed on him over the years, whether it be on the podcast or in real life, chops on the chest, giant shirts, mm-hmm. whatever it may be, mm-hmm. my 6-year-old daughter, I think, lit the bridge on fire Saturday. So she's sitting there talking to Matt, and they're having this conversation. And Matt is like, I don't know what he's trying to do. He's like trying to explain how we grew up together and how I know him and all this stuff. And, mm-hmm. and she just looks him dead in the eye and goes, I don't understand your life. I mean, like you couldn't say that to anybody better than Matt Rotella. It was perfect. I was dying. Greenhouse was dying. even Matt was dying. It was. I mean, like you couldn't have picked a better human being for her to break that line out.
That's
on. I don't know where she got it from.
That is true.
But it is very hard to understand the life of Matt Rotella. She,
yes, every day I try to figure it out.
Summed it up with just one quick sentence there. So
yeah, that's very good.
But no, it was a good time. Mm-hmm. Cowboy Senior, good to meet Dr. G. So it was a meeting of the sports minds there.
Yes, former Evolution co-hosts from both sides of the NFL spectrum. But yeah, no, it's good to see everybody. Senior, haven't seen him since the summer. It's good to see him back. Looking forward to seeing him very soon as the big St. Mary's is around the corner. Just about from now, JR, what, almost 7 weeks away?
Yeah, it'll be 6 weeks from Saturday. I did the math today. So usually right after Memorial Day, I start to piece things together. So
yes.
But no, it was a good party. Lots of good food, some good cookies, dessert, so all that in there.
Everything was great.
All right, indeed.
And what'd you do? And yesterday and today, what'd you do? Anything fun? Memorial Day parade?
Well, yes. Was it? Huh?
Memorial Day parade in Coventry today?
No parades. No. So yesterday, our neighbors had a little gathering. It was supposed to be outside, but ended up obviously being inside. Mr. D'Amato came back here after the fan festival, so he hung out. We watched some of the Hidden Gems Saturday night on the network, the new folder, so that was cool. And then he came with me over to my neighbor's house, so he was there with me and the kids, and he headed home last night, probably around like 8-ish, maybe 8:30, hit the road. And today we didn't do anything. My wife came back from her vacation, and we just hung out. So
relaxed. Good, good. Which neighbors? The ones with the five trucks and flat tires?
No one's allowed. Oh, okay. The house. No, John neighbor.
No one's allowed to walk behind the Sanford and Son swimming pool.
No one ever goes in that house.
No. Anyway, JR. Speaking of wonderful people, we have one this evening to conclude our trinity on this evening's program. Who do we have?
He is the man behind the mic. Greet you from Allentown each and every week on the Pro Wrestling Only feed. I think it's weekly. Peter Winston, is it?
Yes, it is.
There you go. Every week on the Pro Wrestling Only feed, and that is Peter Winston. Peter, how are you?
Yeah, I'm good. I have not missed a week since I started doing the podcast. Yeah, I did throw out like a best of clip show at one point. But it's around the time. Yeah, it's around the time that a sitcom would do that, like near the end of season three, when things start getting a little lazy. I was a little burned out, and then so I threw together that, and then Bruno dies the next day, so it kind of like ruined like what I had put together. But
TNT did clip shows every 3 weeks, so it's all right. Everybody gets away with it.
I'll tell you, from my experience, the clip shows are more work than the. Well, maybe not you, because you're DDP and you fucking script the whole entire thing out, but for most people I would think the clip show is actually more work than actually doing a podcast. For me anyway, it is.
I did write my next show last night. I don't actually script the ums and the ahs. That's actually a quote from Colin Cowherd, who apparently told somebody that once.
Oh,
where he's like, oh yeah, I script everything I say right down to the ums and the ahs. You know who listens to my show? Guys who like to get laid. Like that's Colin Cowherd. And that's why I like to get laid, but I don't listen to Colin Cowherd. So
good. Very good. Well, that's the best of both worlds right there.
Exactly. Yeah. What's good to be on, sir?
It's quite the tangent. Yes, but your show is weekly. I used to not mind doing the clip shows when it was like 50 episodes or 100 episodes or 200.
Right.
I'm like dreading doing any kind of clip thing for 500 guys, because I mean, it's a lot of audio to cull through. So I tried taking on some interns to do the job, and no real takers. So I might be stuck with maybe just a clip here and there. We'll see.
That's impossible. I mean, you got 7 years worth of material, and there's no way you can remember like even a third of it probably.
Right. Yeah. No. And like Chad's our historian, so he kind of marks them down. And actually, last year I was starting to go through our older ones and kind of note like classic spots, but I didn't end up getting very far because I just got caught up with other stuff. And there's so much audio out there and everything else, I barely have time to go back, you know, to listen to like newer stuff, let alone going through 500 episodes of our shit. So it was quite the. I tried, but it was a lot. So. Anyways,
yeah, no, we got a lot to get to, but this evening we don't have to do a clip show, even though the show we're doing was not live. So tonight, for those that listen to our show, when our good friend Peter comes on for a specific show, that means we're going to the Peacock for Saturday night's main event. Your air date, March 12th, 1988, from the municipal. Say that again. Municipal Auditorium in Nashville, Tennessee. Not really WWF's wheelhouse at this time, but they went in there. Hot crowd, though. Very hot crowd. Mm-hmm. Now, the last few shows we've done, JR, the roster has been quiet otherwise. Like the MSG House shows has just been them. The main event, obviously, in Indianapolis, obviously everybody was there. But tonight, on this live Saturday, holy crap, three, obviously, as Vince usually did back in the day, the roster was split in thirds. Four shows, including a doubleheader for one of the rosters. We'll get to that one last. Yeah, we'll get to that one last. One roster was at the Civic Center in El Paso, Texas. Another place kind of out of nowhere, right?
I spent a week there one night.
Yes. Here is your card. Dan Spivey defeated Lanny Poffo. Danny Davis pinned Sam Houston. Jesus, that feud was still going on. If you can call it a feud. Hillbilly Jim pinned Sika. Is that even a feud? The Junkyard Dog defeated a newcomer by disqualification. We'll get to that guy at WrestleMania 4. Has he debuted yet? No, he hasn't. Let's see. The Ultimate Warrior pinned the King Harley Race. The Rougeau Brothers defeated Demolition. Doesn't say by DQ, so must have beat him clean. Jim Duggan pinned Ron Bass, and then Duggan won an 18-man bunkhouse battle royal, last eliminating this new gentleman who was in the WWF in the late 70s. I just watched him on All-Star Wrestling. Him and Ron Bass. The rest of the participants, pretty much the rest of the guys we just heard on the rest of the show, so I'm not going to read them all, including Mr. Fuji and Scott Casey. So, all right. Another part of the roster was at Rosemont Horizon in Chicago, so a good house. Scott Casey defeated Barry Horowitz. The Young Stallions, Paul Roman, Jim Powers defeated the Conquistadors. Rick Rude defeated Ken Patera. The Islanders defeated the British Bulldogs. Sensational Sherry, your women's champion, defeated Rockin' Robin. Jake Roberts fought Hercules to a double countout and a six-man tag in the main event in a steel cage. This was the matches we were talking about last time, JR. The Macho Man Randy Savage and your World Tag Team Champions Strikeforce defeated the Honky Tonk Man and the Hart Foundation in a steel cage match. Do you, we were talking about this on the last show, Peter. Do you remember any of those matches?
I think there was one at was the Boston Garden one, the Warrior and those guys. But I think I saw one of them once, and I said to myself, it's really nice to see Savage and Tito put their differences aside for after all these years.
Exactly.
Savage just did like that a lot. They all like yeah. It's like everyone just wanted to like him. Like they all immediately he's teaming with Jake and Steamboat and Santana like all over the place. So
yeah. It's so funny.
Yeah.
Tito was a charismatic dude.
He was. He was. Another guy who was on All-Star back in 79. Anyway, that was at Rosemont Horizon. Now, this roster, the other third of the roster, had a double dip East Coast. The speaking of the aforementioned Washington Capitals, who were playing Game 1 this evening, we were at the Cap Center on the afternoon show, a crowd of 8,500 in our nation's capital. SD Jones pinned Johnny V. Dino Bravo pinned Coco Beware after the greatest manager in JR's world, Frenchie Martin, interfered. Mm-hmm. The Bolsheviks defeated the Killer Bees. Andre pinned Bam Bam Bigelow with a boot to the face. So Andre was actually wrestling in this time period. They weren't holding him off till WrestleMania. Interesting.
Well, I feel like I feel like that was just for main event. Like they got the big rating, they got the big moment. Now I think it feels this way anyway. Coming up, that he kind of settles into being a member of the roster. Like I feel like his days as like a mythical figure are fading right. a bit. They still exist because of what he is, but I think it shows it four and beyond that he almost just becomes like just a member of the roster now versus like this guy that never wrestles except for these big matches.
I'm just shocked that Johnny V was on that show. Did you say Johnny V versus
I did say Johnny
Jones?
V. Oh, I did say Johnny V. Yeah.
Main event in any ring of the country, Jess.
Yeah, because he had left in like late 87, right?
So I thought Survivor Series was his last show, but it seems like maybe they called him up for one shot or something.
Yeah, must have needed a guy and threw him out there.
Yeah. The Women's Tag Team Champions, the Jumping Bomb Angels, defeated the Glamour Girls. Brutus Beefcake defeated Greg Valentine via disqualification. Hulk Hogan pinned Virgil. And in the main event, oh, God. Don Morocco and George the Animal Steel defeated the One Man Gang and Butch Reed. All right. In the evening, they went a little bit north and went to the Spectrum. Crowd of 10,731 live on the Prism Network. So this was on TV. Oh, God. Listen to this broadcast team. Dick Graham and Craig DeGeorge.
Oh my.
Oofah. Yes. SD Jones and Johnny V get to do it all over again.
Wow.
The Jumping Bomb Angels once again against the Glamour Girls, modified victory roll. This is on the High Flyers DVD. Interesting. Dino Bravo pinned Coco. Bigelow and Don Morocco defeated the One Man Gang and Butch Reed at 14:11. The Killer Bees defeated the Bolsheviks at 10:42 when Blair pinned Zukov with a reverse roll-up after Blair and Brunzell switched places by using the masks. Brutus Beefcake defeated Greg Valentine via DQ. And in the main event, Hulk Hogan defeated Ted DiBiase in a lumberjack match with the leg drop after throwing DiBiase off the top rope despite outside interference from two men wearing Killer Bees face masks. After the bout, Hogan fought off the two masked men and unmasked one of them, but he was wearing a second mask underneath. Other lumberjacks included Virgil, Coco, SD, Johnny V, Beefcake, Bravo, Hammer, and the rest of the stipulation stated Andre the Giant was banned from ringside for this match. And this is on the Hulkamania 4 tape. So as you can see, the World Wrestling Federation had a very busy Saturday live around the world, mostly on the East Coast.
It's kind of cool that they pulled the thing with the bee masks to throw off the scent. It's kind of neat.
Yep. No, I agree. So there is your live house show situation for this Saturday. JR, any other news and notes?
Yeah, we got a few. Since our last MSG show on the 227 Superstars doing a WrestleMania report, it was announced that Hercules would face the Ultimate Warrior and Strikeforce to defend their titles against Demolition at WrestleMania. Like I said, it's during the report. Included the announcement that Vanna White would be the guest timekeeper as well. On the 3-5 Superstars, there was a WrestleMania 4 report where the 20-man Battle Royal was announced, and Robin Leach would be the presenter of the world title belt at that event. And 312, earlier this day on Superstars, Bruno Sammartino's final appearance as a commentator. So I'm guessing it's his final appearance till 2013, right? He didn't do anything in between.
Yeah. Nope.
All right, so there you go.
Nope, so. He doesn't. And I think he takes, like, I think he shows up at Abrams, what is it, UHF? Not UHF, what the fuck is it?
Weird Al was the manager. Yeah.
Weird Al's promotion, yeah.
Exactly. Probably would have been a lot better than Herb Abrams anyway. And then he shows up, in WCW in 90, what is it, Halloween Havoc 92, I think?
Yeah,
right?
Isn't
he referee? Or 91?
He's at the Clash. And then he's at Halloween Havoc as a special ref in 89, so it's actually
89.
Sooner than you think, yeah.
Oh, okay. All right. But then I know he goes to Herb Abrams' promotion. And then we obviously don't see him live on WWE television again until the Hall of Fame in 2013. So.
Well, when you want to go to a drug-free environment, Herb Abrams' UWF is the place to go.
No shit, right?
Good grief.
David Sammartino, fucking Orton. Patera would show up there eventually. Jesus, who else was there? Orndorff. Yeah, it was not incredibly healthy place.
Yeah. Well, Herb Abrams himself.
Well, yeah, that too.
It's the Tony Montana of wrestling promoters.
Yeah. Say hello to my little friend, Ken Patera. All right, JR, why don't we set the scene? Our announcers, as usual, Vincent Kennedy McMahon and Jesse the Body Ventura. And let's open. What do we open with? What are the opening promos?
Okay, we do open with our usual promos. From Randy Savage, Ted DiBiase, Brutus Beefcake, One Man Gang, and Slick, and Hulk Hogan. Vince and Jesse then welcome us to the arena, set the stage for the big night of action as we head toward WrestleMania. And we also revisit footage from the main events, the last time we were here on NBC. Gene is with the Hammer and Jimmy Hart, who run down Brutus Beefcake and say they'll take him out here tonight after Hammer has carried him for years. Gene is then with Brutus Beefcake, who just unloads a bunch of haircutting puns and then walks off. And that does bring us to our big Dream Team blow-off match with Brutus Beefcake taking on Greg the Hammer Valentine. Feud's kind of reignited of late. Of course, they fought a couple of times on those MSG shows that we've seen, Scott. And I believe this was their final match together on TV, so this is it for the Dream
Team.
Yeah,
I think so too. Yeah,
Jimmy leads out the Hammer to booze, and then Beefer struts out to a warm reception. Hammer stalls a bit, gets worked over right away as he slides in. Hammer quickly clubs his way back in as Vince calls him a plotter. Beefer gets a high knee and follows a slam as he continues to unload some offense. Beefer grabs a two on a jackknife as Hammer's off balance, but things finally turn around when Greg goes to the eyes. Beefcake is rattled as Hammer cracks him in the forearm off the top rope. Hammer starts to methodically pick apart Brutus, going for pin covers and also working the leg. Hammer slugs Beefcake to the floor as he rides down there. Honky shows up and taunts him on the mic, deriding him as a challenger. After a break, Honky is escorted out, and Hammer goes back to work on Brutus in the ring, laying in hard, heavy blows and wrecking the leg. Beefcake eventually powers up and makes his run, leveling Hammer with a clothesline and hooking the sleeper. Hammer gets to the ropes and leverages both men to the floor to break the hold. We get some interference from Jimmy Hart. Head back in. Hammer gets a back suplex into a bridge pin, and the ref counts three. Jesse assumes the Hammer won, but the ref calls Beefcake the winner, and we see that he got a shoulder up before three. After the bell, Beefcake snips Hammer's hair as well. This is fine. There's some energy behind it. Pushes Beefcake's issues with Jimmy Hart and Honky, but he doesn't really have much else going on yet. Standard TV fare, notch below the house show work, which I actually liked. Remember, those are the matches that Pete was shitting all over. Not Peter, but
yes.
Pete, Schermacher. All right, talk about that, and then I want to talk about this finish, because I have issues with these finishes overall. But what did you think of the match itself, Scott? I went a star and a half.
I went 2 stars. I didn't think it was too bad. We finally get the on-camera battle, because we've seen it a couple times at the Garden. The commentary with Vince and Jesse, the buzz about the last episode, of course, the controversy. We were less than a month, and this is the same example, and I'm curious your thoughts on this too, Peter, where Saturday's main event always stays very generic. They don't get into too many details. WrestleMania is mentioned here and there, but we don't get into matches and anything like that. Jesse kind of, gloms over the fact that we have a big show coming up in 15 days, but doesn't really get too specific about it. You could see that Honky is transitioned off the Savage finally and is moving over to the Beefer, which is a good thing. Because as we've talked about extensively, JR, Honky needs to move on to somebody else. Savage obviously is starting to get some bigger fish to fry. The ending was kind of dopey. I understand the Jimmy Hart interference, but you know, I think Beefer needed to win this clean and have him move on, because obviously he had something big coming up. So winning this match clean probably having the match end clean, whether Beefcake wins or Honky costs him and Valentine wins, which would fuel what's coming up. But having this weird flim-flam ending doesn't help anybody, particularly Beefcake. But the match itself isn't bad. I like the ripping on Jesse's, Jesse's ripping on Beefcake's half-naked tights with his freaking ass cheeks hanging out. But I thought overall, I think Beefcake has grown as a worker. He's still a little herky-jerky, a lot of punches and kicks. But he could get through a match pretty handily. But I gave it 2 stars. I thought it was fine. But yeah, I agree with you. The ending was stupid. We needed some kind of legitimacy here. And Beefcake gets the definitive win, but it's not really a definitive win. I don't know. It was kind of odd. He needed to win like legit, like knock Beefcake, like knock Valentine out with the sleeper and make it kind of conclusive. I don't know what you think, Peter, but overall the match was fine.
Well, Vince, at the beginning, it kind of exposes the fact that he likes everything big, you know, big wrestlers or whatever, because he calls the hedge clippers that Beefcake has scissors. Now, I don't know what he thinks scissors are, but that is legitimately a weapon. Actually, off this, Valentine and Beefcake, there's that famous picture of them sitting, drinking beer in the chairs that I've seen like last year. I like that picture. It really makes me happy seeing that they're still pals after all these years. I mean, Valentine obviously suffering many back injuries carrying Beefcake through the years. And I like that they did the atomic drop spot, because Valentine, all the headlines go to Rude and other dudes for being atomic drop sellers, and Valentine's definitely up there. It's nice to see him reborn a little bit after basically his whole 87 was just a complete waste of time, and it made me actually feel bad for him. Mm-hmm. But you know, Beefcake, he's a bit of a punchline, and especially with his gear, which I'll never look at the same way again after listening to Jeff Machado on Jeff Learns Wrestling. Because getting that kind of perspective, like, you know what? He's kind of right. Like, why is there like, it's mostly skin that he's showing, and then there's like the nylons. But he was popular, and he wasn't that bad, I don't think.
No, and he improves as we get along here. I mean, he's already improved, right? In 85, he was real rough in some of those early ones we watched. But as we moved forward, he's gotten better. Obviously, Hammer helped him with that. But no, he continues to build. I think he's actually well-suited in the face role, because the selling is probably his best aspect. You know what I mean? So, like, him being able to take a shit-kicking for 10 minutes and then getting the sleeper is probably the best route for him.
He learned a little bit. He learned, like, a few things that he could do, the little strut that, you know, people would react to. I did get distracted during this match because at ringside I noticed this ominous table there. I don't know if that's going to come into play or anything like that, but when Honky came down, seeing that belt on him, it just looked right on him with the jumpsuit, and like the way the belt looks on him is better, I think, than any IC champion that there ever was. I think Jimmy Hart did good work at ringside there, but holy crap, what a shit finish this was. I mean, the double pin, could you stop doing this? They were doing it on like every super show. It makes Valentine look like a complete moron because, oh, I'm going to go for a pin, but I'm just going to leave both my shoulders down. It's like, oh, this two-decade veteran of the business doesn't know to like put his shoulder up. I had this at 2.5 stars, but I'm downgrading it to 1.5. Although I did like the line, and I think it was Jesse that said it. He lost his coat, but he saved his tail. When Beefcake stole the Jimmy Hart Hart's jacket.
But that finish, I hate that fucking finish. And I talked about that too, Peter, on Jeff Lynch Wrestling. I kind of hinted at it. It's just such a lazy, confusing, convoluted finish. And we'll see it again, Scott, in a couple weeks. But I can't stand it. Like, the logistics, and Jeff called it out, the logistics of it make really no sense. And like you said, Peter, he's a veteran. He should know, like, oh my God, he got his shoulder up. Well, you know, like, he should be fully aware that his shoulder's probably going up. But it's just, it's just like, it's not quite 50-50 booking. Like, it's not like the fuck finish count out kind of thing, but it's like 51-49, right? It's like as close as it can get while still being clean, to be in just like lucky. Like, I'd prefer just a roll up. Like, if you had to do like a flash pin like that. It's confusing for the fans. Anything that has to be like really over and explained shouldn't exist in wrestling. I think that's why people have issues with Vince Russo, but that's neither here nor there. But when you need the convoluted explanations for what's just happened, it's time to retire the idea. And sadly, they do not retire this idea. So we see it quite a bit more. But yeah, I despise the bridge finish. I always have.
Yeah, I do too.
All right.
So and thank God we're out of it.
Yeah. A full star downgrade right on air from Peter.
I know. Look at that, huh? Yeah. Pete would have given it 4.5.
Well, he hated that house show match with them.
Yeah, he did.
He was reading Jobbers over it. All right. Gene is with Harley Race and Bobby Heenan, who's proud to say he's partly responsible for Hulk Hogan no longer being champion. Race says it's been proven that Hulk is mortal, and all mortals bow to the king. Heenan says he will also kiss Harley's feet tonight. Gene's then with the Hulkster, says Harley's the last thing in his way before WrestleMania. Andre the Giant can never beat him, and he won't bow to Harley. He only bows to the big man, brother, up in heaven. And that brings us to, I guess, our nominal, actually, a few matches tonight, but one of our main events. That is Hulk Hogan taking on the King Harley Race, a fun match on paper with Pinball Harley against the bomb-throwing Hulkster. Jesse thinks Hulk will be off his game, though, tonight, as he's without the title for the first time in a long time. Big pop for Hogan as he powers out to the ring, and Bobby backs off. Hulk sprints in after the break, but Harley jumps him and lands some shots. Hulk fires back and stands over the King as he gets stripped down, and we settle down. The music finally ends. Hogan pours it on as Harley bumps it crazy, gets clothesline over the top into a table. Hulk follows and keeps unloading and slams him to the floor. Bobby distracts Hulk, and Harley tries for a pile driver, but Hulk reverses it to a backdrop and hits an atomic drop. Vince thinks we're seeing a new, more aggressive Hulk with no title involved. Hulk finally pitches Race back in and keeps running through him, eventually landing an axe bomber and then chokes away. Jesse starts bitching about Hogan's buddy referee, Joey Morella, who lets him do whatever he wants. Bobby gets involved again, allows Harley to nail him from behind. The King goes through his usual offense, really measuring and executing well, as always. We go back outside where Harley puts Hogan on a table and goes to the apron and comes off with a headbutt. Hulk dodges and he busts through it in a real fun yet ugly spot. And as we know, of course, that would end up injuring Harley and put him on the sidelines for a bit. Harley recovers, hits a headbutt off the top rope for two. Hogan hulks up and the crowd is rabid as he starts to pepper away, hitting his clotheslines and dropping the leg for the win. Heenan attacks but escapes before Hogan can get his hands on him. This is real fun. It was a wild brawl that never stopped. Had some great bumps with the table spot as well. Just a real hell of a fun match. I went 3 stars. It reminded me of some of those Hogan MSG matches we watched early on, like in 86, 85, 86, Scott, like the Savage ones, the Morocco right. ones. Like it just had that sprint, aggressive, brawling feature to it that we don't really see in the Hogan TV matches. So I appreciated that, and it was what I expected it to be. Harley just, you know, pinballing around for him. And, of course, the table spots were fun, but, you know, sad at the same time. What did you think of this one, Peter?
Well, during the interview segment, with the way Harley had, like, the crown awkwardly placed and just kind of how old he looks. And now this is a very obscure reference here. He kind of looks like the cartoon king from the 1971 Brady Bunch episode, The Winner. The one where Bobby gets into, like, the pie-eating contest and he loses to the morbidly obese kid.
Yes,
Okay, so he looks kind of like that guy. I think it's like Hal Smith or something like that is the actor's name. Mm-hmm. This actually got me thinking about Hogan matches in this run without the title. So, you know, up through, 92 and wondering, is this the best one other than maybe one with a certain guy from Georgia that we're going to meet later in 88? I think this is in contention, because I really enjoyed this. With Hogan's taped fists was kind of noticeably odd. It was interesting. I kind of wish that he'd draw like a circle with an X on it, because Hogan also had a cult of personality. It didn't have any shoot promos or anything, but I like the aggressiveness that he was showing, that Vince was putting over, made a lot of sense given how he just got screwed. Race getting backdropped from the pile driver attempt gave a young Steve Austin a spot that he would use in every Attitude Ever match down the road. The belly to belly was solid. I don't know why, but I really popped for that move. It was taken well and it was delivered well. But
yeah, Harley always really nails that.
Yeah.
Yes.
I mean, it helps when the guy, I mean, maybe when it's JYD, you know, and there's not much help, but. But this match comes down to one thing, and it's that goddamn table at ringside. I mean, who the hell decided to use that particular brand of table, which
The amusing thing about that, given what happened to Harley out of this, is he kind of no-sells it. It's kind of weird that he kind of just sort of gets up. He angrily shoves the table, like, what the hell? And then he gets back into the ring to finish the match. I mean, he's a real warrior. And by the way, the fact that they made him work against the Ultimate Warrior, like, days after that, as you said, during the house show roundup, it's like, poor Harley Race during this time period. It's like the worst week of his life. And also,
Does that end up being his last match, the Warrior one?
I think, well, he comes back Royal Rumble the following year, but he comes back at the end of the year, right?
Yeah, he's back by, I think he's back in, he's at Survivor Series. So.
And he's at four.
Yeah, so I meant his last match before he goes on the shelf, is what I meant. So.
Well, he works the Battle Royal, I think.
Oh,
I
right,
think
the yeah. Royal, yeah, he's in the Battle Royal for him. Yeah.
But seeing the table there and the fact that this is in Nashville, which, by the way, I'm flying to Nashville on Thursday, so fun and timing on this. Harley Race, 1988, goes through a table in Nashville, suffers a bad injury. Ric Flair, 1989, Wrestle War, suffers a bad injury getting pile driven on a table in Nashville by Terry Funk. So that just made me think, I'm shocked that Scott's boy Triple H didn't just hurl himself through a table at, like, Judgment Day 02 or something like that. I mean, like, well, Harley did it and Rick did it. You know, why can't I? But this is this was a fun TV version of the house show feud from 87 that was really good. I give 2.5 for this.
So you should stay away from tables, you're saying, when you go out there next week.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I'm just going to stay away entirely.
All right, so Harley, let's put the bow on Harley's run here. So not his run, but this current stretch before he goes out the injury. So he has this injury here, which was, what date was this, we said?
Well, it aired March 12th.
Okay, so March 7th it was recorded. So he fights on the March 8th challenge taping, and then March 10th house show, March 12th house show. Twice he does double duty there, Battle Royal as well. March 13th fights Warrior, 14th he fights Warrior. Again on the 14th he fights Outback Jack, Warrior again on the 15th, Warrior again on the 16th, George Steele on the 19th, Steele again on the 20th. Then he's at Mania, he's in the Battle Royal. He gets subbed out in Providence on April 23rd, subbed out again on April 26th, and then he fights Morocco in Nova Scotia. I'm wondering if that was – it doesn't have results. It just has the card, so I wonder if he got subbed out that match because that's the only one that shows him, like, after that. And then on 618 Superstars, they announced that Harley had to abdicate his throne because he was hurt by Hogan in the at the table. So it looks like he ended up having a few matches after that. So I wonder if he was just trying to gut through it. No pun intended.
As covered on Greetings from Allentown, episode 24, I covered that Superstars.
There you go. Make sure you check that out after you listen to this. So he must have, I'm guessing he probably was just trying to cover it up and then eventually had to forced to get checked out, right?
Yeah, I think that's what was one of those injuries where they're like, they removed 51.4 miles of intestine from Harley Race. So like, all right, we don't need, like, the mileage on that. That's gross.
I gave this 2.5. This match was really good. Now, just to give everyone background on what the actual injury was, this was one of those tables. Obviously, the tables we use today, or they use today in modern WWE, are those, you know, flim-flam fucking folding jobs that, you know, fall apart when a midget hits it. Now, but back then, I mean, they didn't do table spots, so the spots were like, the tables were, you know, actual tables, the kind that places use for things. And this was one of those, and I remember having these tables in my grammar school. It was one of those, like balsa wood tables, but they had the metal ring around it, or the metal thing around it, you know, to keep it together. And it didn't fold in the middle. It folded up. And apparently Harley lands on it, and the metal piece goes into his stomach, into his abdomen, and causes a hernia. That's what the actual injury is. So this guy wrestles with this fucking $2 steak, wrestles with a fucking hernia for 3 months, getting the shit beat out of him by the Warrior. You know, that's like, oh, man, I have like a hole in my stomach. Would you like to wrestle Stan Hansen for 6 months? You know, what I'm saying? It's like Jesus Christ. So that's what the actual injury is. He actually, and you're right. He pushes the fucking table like, fuck that shit. You know, and he fucking, you know. He's awesome. Love you, Harley.
Yeah, for just battling through. Or maybe Vince gave him the old, you know, we need you, pal. You know, like, gut through it kind of thing. And then He eventually just succumbed to it, but
yeah. Talking about Hogan for a minute, as I'm watching this again, I mean, probably all like the billionth time we've seen it, but really looking at it this time, the Hogan with the, it's funny you bring up the taped fist, Peter, because it was neat finally seeing Hogan this vicious, like playing up the fact that for the first time in our new, in our modern Federation era history, this guy is coming out to the ring on national television with an empty waist and it's pissing him off.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a good thing.
Yeah.
Like, we don't, like, you know, Vince was smart to kind of let Hogan be a little unhinged. It's okay. He's mad. Good guys can get mad, too.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? So it was nice for him to come out and be a little unhinged. He didn't need to be like a sociopath and, you know,
right.
you know, beat him up with a chair or whatever, kill Harley. But to be frustrated that, you know, I'm getting, I got jobbed out and now I gotta do this tournament thing, you know, he's pissed.
Yeah.
And he has a right to be pissed. And
it continues into four, which is a nice touch. Like, so they kind of build it here, and unless you watch all this stuff in order, you may not pick up on the subtlety of Hogan, you know, doing what he had to do to get revenge because he got screwed with so badly. But it does begin here with him basically saying, "I'm going up a notch."
Yeah, and he's, you know, he's choking Harley with the fist tape, and I mean, it was great. I loved seeing it, and like in two different, and it's great that you see Jesse and Vince approaching it different ways. Like, Vince is acting like, you know, here's Hogan, he's frustrated, you know, he's kind of going a little outside of his comfort zone and everything. And Jesse's like, I love seeing the fact that Hogan is crazed. All right, he's not your perfect hero. He's got a chip on his shoulder, and it's nice to finally see that kind of thing. So it was fantastic to see both announcers approaching Hogan's thinking differently. Made for very good announcing, in my opinion, in this match. And the match was just really good, and Harley's just Harley. I mean, like I said, he's a $2 steak. I mean, clearly, you know, his guts get ripped out, and meanwhile, he keeps wrestling for 3 months. Was it better than the house show matches? It's not often you say that about a Saturday Night's main event match because of pacing and stuff, but I'll put this match up against those, against the house show matches. They worked really well together. Like, I think Hogan was honored to work with a guy that was probably his idol back in the day when he was first getting into the business, you know, but when Hogan was getting in, you know, Harley was the world champion. So he was probably honored in that aspect. And Harley was like, you know what? I'm going to put the guy over. It's my job. You know, it's what I do. They did it for me. I'm doing it for them. So it was good to see. It was good to see the match go this way, to see Hogan kind of be this kind of out of his skin character kind of thing. And it's making WrestleMania 4 very unique in terms of what we're looking for, because regardless of what happens, and we'll get there, right now you're pretty much expecting Hogan to win the thing back.
Mm-hmm.
And this is him being unhinged, and I'm going to go in as a crazed lunatic, and, you know, DiBiase and Andre, and then better watch out because the Hogan they've seen before is not the Hogan they're going to see March 27th, you know, at Trump. So that is making for a great narrative from here on out. So really great match. Harley's a tough son of a bitch, and Hogan is working a style that he probably hasn't worked since AWA, really, you know, except for the occasional house show match here and there where we've said, JR, in the past that he's gone out of his comfort zone on the local level, but stays in his usual, you know,
right,
cookie cutter style on national TV, but locally he kind of will go off the
rails. Even that,
a well, bit,
I guess,
you know?
I mean, we haven't seen him, I guess, too much in MSGs, but I feel like that kind of went away later in '87. But we'll see how it continues as we move forward. But I mean, I guess in fairness, we haven't really seen him much. I don't think.
True.
What was the last house show we even saw him at?
The tag. Was it January?
Yeah, all right, true.
Bigelow.
So, yeah, and so. I guess he's working a little aggressive there. It's hard in the tag setting to see,
right,
you know, what we had been seeing. But I feel like in the fall, he wasn't there. Yeah, in the fall, he wasn't really on at all, right?
I don't think so.
Yeah.
No, because Andre wasn't around. Let me take a look at I want to look at the awards, because Andre usually beats the shit out of somebody in the awards.
Back to, like, I think his last one might have been May against Harley. Oh, no, in June. May and June he fought Harley. And I don't think he was on MSG again until that tag.
Yeah, right.
Grace Paul, Josh Hogan. I lied. He fights Gang in September.
Yeah.
Okay. All right, so there you go. Yeah, September was his last time he was on.
And he was still champion, so obviously he was approaching things differently. So, any event, great match, and Hogan wins, and we move on.
Okay. All right, Gene is with Ted DiBiase and Virgil. Ted talks about the politics going on as well as his match tonight. Ted dances around the questions about his corner man this evening and says he destroyed Hulkamania and he'll take out Randy Savage as well. Gene is with Savage. He talks about DiBiase coming up bankrupt when he tried to buy Hulkamania. Says he'll have Liz in his corner, the bravest manager in the world. And that does bring us to our next match, and that is Randy Macho Man Savage taking on the Million Dollar Man Ted DiBiase. Of course, neither DiBiase is not champion here. Neither is Andre the Giant. The title is vacated. Big match as we edge towards four in the tournament. Great reception for Savage and Liz, but then Andre the Giant struts out after their entrance and takes his place in Ted's corner. Virgil talks to Liz off the bell. Savage comes out and smacks him. That allows Ted to jump him and throw him back in. Ted goes to work with chokes and strikes, and Jesse talks about the advantage that Andre gives Ted and compares it to Liz and says that makes it easier. Ted keeps the attack on Savage, as Savage can't get a free second to gather himself. Jesse wonders which Hebner this is, and Vince says it's Dave. He's been fingerprinted this evening to ensure it's the right one.
That's funny.
Savage finds an opening and lands an elbow, follows with some offense. Savage knocks Ted outside, brings him right back in, and hits a double axe handle. Savage keeps unloading until Ted slides out to confer with Andre. Ted returns and takes control again with some basic offense, and the two trade control until DiBiase goes to a step over toe hold. Savage blocks a third one by kicking DiBiase over the top. Savage follows out, but Andre steps in his way, allowing Virgil to clobber him from behind to booze. Hebner throws Virgil out as Andre keeps the peace. After break, Virgil's gone, and Ted is working over Savage, going to a chin lock. Savage escapes and starts to pepper Ted with punches and clotheslines and gains some momentum more and more by the second. DiBiase accidentally wipes out Hebner. Savage jumps Ted and hits him with an axe off the top, but Andre catches him, drops him with a headbutt, and shoots him into the post. Liz runs away as Andre's viciously battering Savage at ringside while Ted shields Hebner until he implores him to start counting, and Macho is indeed counted out, giving DiBiase the win. Ted and Virgil smack Savage around until Hogan comes out with a chair to make the save. Fun match. There was a lot of heat here. Started slow, but really got cranking halfway through. Andre's just been awesome, destroying Savage at ringside. And I thought it was really solid. It keeps us chugging toward Mania. I went 3 stars on this, and I think it was key to give DiBiase the win, because you really want to plant the seed that, like you said, Scott, many people are probably thinking Hogan's winning the tournament. But this gives DiBiase a little bit of a bump, too. He's the guy that fucked Hogan, and now he gets a win over Savage. So, you know, I'm guessing people in their minds were thinking Hogan and DiBiase advancing. But, of course, when you look at the bracket, that's not really possible. In the original bracketing, it was. I guess we'll probably talk about that next week, Scott, our pre-show special, how the brackets changed from the beginning till what they got to. So we'll talk about that. But 3 stars here. I really enjoyed this one.
I did too. 3 stars as well. It was very high octane. I mean, they put the foot on the gas, and DiBiase is a bumping machine. That's one thing. And I was watching the Pritchard podcast, the network one, a couple weeks ago when they did DiBiase, and that's exactly what Bruce was saying, that even more than the fact that he had a great offense, Teddy knew how to really put over another guy's offense in whatever that offense may be. And he showed it in this match. I mean, he's throwing himself all over the place. Savage is right now in a real mental groove. I feel like the last 4 or 5 months of 87, while he was trying to kind of get his feet wet as a babyface, there was still, you know, he was still trying to figure out how not to really act like a heel and totally cheat in his matches without losing that edge. I think this is the first match, and maybe stuff we've seen earlier in the year, but definitely this match where we've seen this full-blown now babyface Savage, where he's not cheating to get ahead. He's cheating out of revenge, which is what babyfaces do, kind of what Hogan was doing in the previous match. And I think that has made him a better wrestler, actually. And Teddy just sold for him like a son of a bitch. And I don't know if this was, and I'm curious your thoughts, guys. That at the beginning of the match when Virgil was kind of fucking with Elizabeth and fucking Savage like just pimp slaps him hard twice, and I'm thinking, I don't know, is he pissed off or something? Was that a receipt or something? Because I mean, he smacked Virgil hard.
Still his Olive Garden gift card.
Yeah. Exactly. With the breadsticks.
When did Olive Garden open, by the way? Like, is it old? Like what year? 82 looks like it started. So there you go. I was wondering if it was open by then, like when Olive Garden started becoming.
Yeah, but Connecticut didn't come until, I don't know, 96 probably.
Yeah, I want to say it was like early to mid 90s here too. It looks like by 89 it was 145. So between in seven years they blew up pretty quick.
Yeah, but you know what? It's not. It's not. It's not as good as our other place,
Golden Corral.
No, the other Italian, our other Italian chain,
Maggiano's,
Bertucci's.
No, the other one, no, the one with the funny name that was in Manhattan. Chad likes it.
Oh, Buca di Beppo.
Buca di Beppo. Yeah, because you know, Peter, there's a Buca di Beppo in the North End. Yeah, right. anyway, this match is really good. Teddy's like again bumping like a machine. Savage is in now this babyface craze groove, and I'm really liking the way the babyfaces are wrestling tonight. Even Beefcake kind of had an edge to him, and I'm kind of liking it. It's it's just a different feeling right now with the fact, and I think a lot of it has to do with the narrative that the belt is vacant.
Yeah,
I think that's causing like everybody, faces, heels, to be almost on edge. That wow, you know, Hogan is not clutching it like a, you know, it's actually out there for anybody to go after, and I think that's adding something to everybody's matches. I feel like that's the narrative they're trying to bring out. I don't know what you think, Peter, but I feel like that everybody's adding a little something because in kayfabe, creatively, oh my God, the world title is vacant for the first time ever. You know, and I think it's adding something to everybody's matches.
And the thought that, well, in theory, anybody could win it, which is how they're kind of presenting it.
Exactly.
Although, you know, as Jesse said, wouldn't it be a disgrace if Duggan won the title? You'll hear on the next show. But yeah, this is a fun match that I think kind of gets forgotten because of what happens later. It establishes that DiBiase, Andre, Virgil, that they're going to cheat like crazy to get what they want. It was a great match to get to the match, I think. So
right.
kind of like the pre-match or whatever. Now, you probably knew that I was going to do something like this when they said this line, where Ted says that Andre is worth his weight in gold. So I took the liberty of looking up gold prices from March 11th, 1988, so the Friday before, and gold closed at $441.80 per ounce on the commodities exchange. So multiplying it times Andre being billed at 520, 16 ounces per pound, that brings him to $3.675 million. So, and that's higher than any player in Major League Baseball at the time or the NBA. So to call him, you know, the world's greatest athlete, I guess I can go along with that. But you know how I've been calling him the closer, where they've been bringing him out, where he restores order at the end. Well, Ted must be into the Tampa Bay Rays because he actually brings him out in the first inning here and has Andre there right at the beginning to say, all right, well, he's going to be here. I'm not going to have him come in later. The notion of fingerprinting officials was hilarious.
That's great.
But the fact that Hebner is there, and I think Pritchard talked about this on one of his old shows, and this is one of those things where I actually will 100% buy what he said, that Vince didn't think that anybody would notice. Like, what the fuck, man? He's in, like, the biggest angle on national TV, and then you just throw him out there like nothing happened. And they're like,
yeah.
Oh, yeah, yeah, we had fingerprints. In a DiBiase match, too!
Right, right.
I mean, it's so preposterous. Yeah. It actually makes me angry. It's like, if this happened in WCW or another promotion, people would never stop talking about how stupid it was. But because it was the WWF, people, like, kind of looked the other way. I was wondering, like, because as I was watching this, I'm watching Savage, because you guys praised Ted, and he was fantastic here. And Savage, I think, might be the best Saturday Night Main Event match worker there is, because it's kind of a skill to have, because you have less time, but you still have to tell a story for the national audience.
Mm-hmm.
And the way he kind of operates, where he kind of goes at, like, jet speed, I think makes him the best guy that they've had since these launched up in 85. However, I give him and Liz a demerit because they were not color coordinated on this night.
They were saving it for Atlantic City.
That's right. It seems like it, but
no, but you're right. He's had some of the best matches they've had, right? I mean, they got the Jake match, the Brett match, this match. I mean, he's definitely building a catalog of great, you know, overlook the times you saddle with steel, I guess, but non-steel category, he's had probably the best catalog of matches of anyone on Science Man event so far.
Yeah. And Elizabeth going to with the traditional closer role in Hogan, bringing him in the ninth. And one thing that I noticed when Hogan comes in with the chair, when he comes into the ring, he loses the chair out of his hand, and it, like, slides right over to DiBiase. And I thought, come on, Ted, why don't you just grab it? He just threw the chair into the ring. You could just grab it and swing away at Hogan. But obviously, you know, that was just an error by Hogan's had a lot of overthrows lately between that and hurling Hebner over the cutoff man on the main event.
Yeah,
this was a terrific match. I'm glad that Scott, in kind of the pre-production that we were doing, that pointed out how good of a match this was. I gave it, like you guys, 3 stars, and almost willing to go to 3.5, but because they were not color coordinated, only 3.
Well, I'll be curious how it stacks up with 4 for you guys. Like, I'm curious how you think it matches up, because 4 to me is good. But I'm wondering if you put it on par with this one, because this is kind of the forgotten one that they have.
Mm. The crowd helps here, because
yes. Oh, for sure,
the crowd is into it, and there's not that sweetening that you would sometimes hear on the NBC show.
Right. No, they were fired up. Do you guys think it's actually a really nicely done red herring to have them fight here? Like, I wonder how many people would think they would give away. I mean, I guess if you're a believer, right, it doesn't matter. But if, you know, if you're kind of in the know a bit, do you think they did this to try and throw people off the scent? Like, oh, would they really have the, you know, if you look at the bracket, Savage DiBiase could only meet in the finals. So would they really give away their WrestleMania main event 2 weeks before on Sinus main event? So, I mean, you wonder if that was intentional on their part or just the way it fell.
I think it was probably a practice run or a dry run.
Yeah.
Just because how often had these two guys actually been in the same ring in the past? So you want to get, if it's going to be the main event of your biggest show of the year, you probably want to establish that maybe these guys have a little bit of chemistry so that they know what works, what doesn't work, all that.
Right. No, I agree with that. I think it's a dry run too. And I think in the long run, when you're watching the pay-per-view, you may not, well, which you won't remember, most wrestling fans do, but I think you'll get caught up in the moment when you're actually watching the show and probably don't remember that they actually did wrestle. But I agree with Peter. I think it was ironing out the kinks. I mean, they did it for Savage and Steamboat. I guess they wrestled before they actually announced the match, but I like the dry run idea.
Yeah.
So, all right. Why don't we take a break? Great show so far, JR. Not bad, right?
No, it's really good. Yeah. No, I was digging it. Yeah, I was definitely feeling it.
And the crowd was pumped for a Nashville crowd.
Mm-hmm.
I thought they were red hot, right, Peter? I mean, hotter than I thought. I remember them being.
Yeah, you wouldn't think of this as WWF country at the time, but
that might be what's making them so hot, though, right? Because they probably don't get. I mean, how often do they get WWF shows? So you wonder if that was aiding in them being super fired up, you know, and especially like a big televised show, not just like a shitbag house show.
They actually did have a wrestling challenge taping, I think, earlier in '88 in January. So they had one before, but I mean, this is a much bigger deal than that. It's not the B show.
Right. So, all right, when we come back, we have 2 matches left and more prepping and preening for WrestleMania 4. After this, because...
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
Hey, pro wrestling announcer Kevin Kelly here. I want to make sure you are all subscribed to all the great feeds here at Place to Be Nation. It's really easy to do. Just head to iTunes or your preferred podcatcher app today and search and subscribe to the Place to Be Nation wrestling feed, which, of course, includes the full archives of the Kevin Kelly Show, the Place to Be Nation pod feed, and the pro wrestling only feed. Subscribe, listen, and then rate us and leave feedback today. And be sure to give Justin your true thoughts. I mean, don't hold back. After all, he is kind of a jerk. Just listen to Scott.
Place for Nations, JT Rosero and Chad Campbell here. We want to let you know that we have a ton of great podcasts available to you on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PlaceForNation.com. We offer them to you on two great feeds. On the Place for Nation Wrestling feed, we bring you the Mothership, the Place to Be podcast, along with Main Event, Survey Says, the Monday Night Wars, and our monthly pay-per-view reaction show, as well as Jeff Learns Wrestling. In addition to these full-length shows, we also deliver special network podcasts and pod blasts on topics old and new.
Over on the Pro Wrestling Only feed, we dive deep inside the wrestling business with a stacked army of experts leading the way. The feed features potpourri shows such as This Week in Wrestling, Greetings from Allentown, Match of the Week podcast, and the Military Industrial Suplex. We also have shows that focus intently on certain topics like Through the Years, WorldCast, Strong Style History, Strong Style Story, and Mount Olympus. Plus, the feed has the full archives of legendary shows like Titans of Wrestling, Where the Big Boys Play, Letters from Center Stage, and Letters from Kayfabe, plus much more. And on our very popular Place to Be Nation Pop podcast feed, we offer such great shows as Talking Pop, the Glenn Butler Podcast Hour Spectacular, NBA Team, PTBN Play, Sunday Groove, Breaking Balls, and Lucha Undead, as well as a veritable podcast heaven for comics fans with the hard-traveling Bad Boys, Sellers Points, Todd Weber's Conversations, Geek and Sassy, and Marvel Age Podcasts.
You can find all of these current shows, plus archives of our past podcasts, including The Kevin Kelly Show, as well by subscribing to both feeds on iTunes. And while there, be sure to rate and leave feedback today. All these shows, plus others, available at PlaceForNation.com, where we cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus in-depth stretch projects, and more. Be sure to support our site by using PlaceForNation.com/Amazon when doing your online shopping, and download our free PTB Vintage Vault Refresh ebooks via the links on our site. We also want to thank our friends at Boneheads Wing Bar in West Warwick, Rhode Island, in Fall River, Massachusetts, and TheHistoryOfWrestling.com. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr as well. PlaceForNation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Hey, this is Ed Banger Thrasher, and you're listening to Where? What the fuck is it? The Place to Be podcast, so you better not miss it because I'm on it.
We are back looking at the March 1988 Saturday Night's Main Event. Myself, Scott Criscolo, Peter Winston from Greetings from Allentown. Hulk Hogan, of course, no longer a champion, and when he looked at Vince McMahon dead in the eye, said, "I'm never going to give that belt up, brother. It's mine forever, you N-word something." But so there he was, forced to hand over his belt. And then I think Honky Tonk Man, if you believe rumor, did the same thing. But that all said, speaking of never giving things up, that is a song you hear underneath us tonight for the Pop Culture Corner with Scott Briscolo. It is Rick Astley, the number one song in the nation this week in 1988. And I'm going to go ahead and pass things off to my PIC.
Thank you, PIC. And yes, we are being Rickrolled this evening, or on this day, March 12th. It is a Saturday, March 12th, 1988. The number one song in the country was Rick Astley and Never Gonna Give You Up. At number two, George Michael with Father Figure from the awesome Faith album. Little Patrick Swayze, She's Like the Wind. At number three,
She's
from, of
like
course,
the wind.
In my tree. Third song off the Dirty Dancing soundtrack that's made it in
real
the,
quickly, by the way, speaking of She's Like the Wind, we forget to mention going to break, but you would have heard it, Scott, because it is Memorial Day, the unofficial start of summer. Of course, that also means the summer of Yacht Rock returns here for the Place to Be podcast every week. Or every episode as we head to break will be a new Yacht Rock cut. So there you go. So keep that in mind as we head to break throughout the summer.
As we head to break, yes. We'll have the greatness of Marty Balin, Little Toto, some
Hall & Oates, and of course, Benny to cap things off at the end.
And forget,
at number
and
four, a little Belinda Carlisle.
Oh, I was going to say, don't forget the flagship of that channel, Christopher Cross.
That's right.
Oh, of course. Yes. Yes. Sailing.
And then Michael McDonald, the father and godfather of that show.
Father and godfather.
Kenny Loggins is the nephew.
Yes. So we go from She's Like the Wind to Ride Like the Wind. at number four, I Get Weak by Belinda Carlisle.
Sisters of the Voices.
Yes. At number five, Endless Summer Nights, Richard Marx. He's a little too late for Yacht Rock, but he would fit right in. Number six, Just Like Paradise by David Lee Roth, which is one of my favorite Roth solo cuts. Number seven, Little Michael, Man in the Mirror. Great song. Out of the Blue by Debbie Gibson. It's Peter's Girl at number eight. At number nine, we have I Want Her by Keith Sweat. That's JR's guy. Mm-hmm. And at number 10, Little Gloria Estefan and the Miami Sound Machine with Can't Stay Away from You. So there was your top 10 that came out on that day, March 12th, 1988, and Little Rick Roll as Rick Astley.
God, that feels early for Keith Sweat. 88, huh?
I know, yeah, huh? It had to have been his first hit, or maybe second hit. So, all right, JR, three movies came out.
He was just a little bit twisted over you.
That's right. Three movies came out on this day. The first one is a fine romance mystery thriller called Masquerade. It's got a pretty good cast, too.
Yes.
Masquerade. Let's see.
I looked it up, but I have no recollection of seeing that movie.
I do. I do remember it.
Was a very good cast.
Would help if I sold Masquerade correctly. Okay, here we go. It's a 1988 American romance mystery thriller film directed by Bob Swaim. Young yachting, gosh, here you go, a little yacht rock here. Young yachting captain Tim Whalen, having an affair with Brooke Morrison, the wife of his boss Granger Morrison, in the upscale town of Southampton, Long Island. Tim is a new captain of Granger's racing sailboat, Obsession. Young heiress Olivia Lawrence, following the recent death of her mother, returns home to Southampton after graduating for college. At a party, Olivia is introduced to Tim, who asks her to dance. Impressed with her knowledge of sailing, Tim asks her to go sailing with him, and she accepts. Starring Rob Lowe, Meg Tilly, Kim Cattrall, Doug Savant, John Glover, Bernie McInerney, McInerney.
McInerney.
McInerney? McInerney? There's no Bernie A. I think it's McInerney.
Yeah. McInerney, yeah.
Yeah. Ira Wheeler and a bunch else. Dick Wolf.
Anybody else out of the blue there? No. So, yeah, no, this was like one of Rob Lowe's like first like serious kind of sinister movies at the time. All right. The second one is, I believe this is a... another great war film. This is called Off Limits. This one I don't remember.
I don't remember that at all, but I can say that Rob Lowe had a much more adult film come out later in 88, as I recall.
Yes. That is true. That was the first one for him.
He was the forerunner of that sort of
yes.
genre.
He was absolutely riding like the wind, yes. Yes. Although said during the war, the tale is more of a mystery than a story about the war. Sergeant First Class Buck McGriff, Sergeant First Class Albaby Packins are two Joint Service Criminal Investigation Division agents on a duty in war-torn Saigon. When a prostitute is found murdered, they discover that the prime suspects are high-ranking U.S. Army officers. As they investigate, they find that there's been a string of at least six murders in the last year, but the previous inquiry was shut down from higher up the chain of command. Investigations led them to Colonel Dexter Armstrong, but Armstrong rules himself out of inquiries by committing suicide with the help of French nun Sister Nicole and their non-commissioned officer in charge, Master Sergeant Dix. They finally close in on the target. And blah, blah, blah. Starring Willem Dafoe, Gregory Hines, Fred Ward, Amanda Pays, Lim Kai Tong, Raymond O'Connor, Richard Brooks, Woody Brown, Ken Sue, Richard Lee Reed. I'm just naming names. Keith David. There you go.
I love Lim Kai Tong's character name, Lime Green. Yes. Sounds like a manager in like AWA or something.
Back room.
Yes, Buck Zumhoff's new manager is Lime Green.
Lime Green.
Our final movie that came out the day before, Friday the 11th, JR, is actually a very well-known movie that actually stood the test of time. I think it's in the Library of Congress, too. Kind of the, I guess you could say it's the Hispanic equivalent of Lean on Me, and that is Stand and Deliver. You definitely remember that one, Peter.
Yes. Yes, I do.
Exceptional film. Exceptional film.
Jaime Escalante, I'm going to assume it's Jaime, becomes a math teacher at James A. Garfield High School in East Los Angeles. The school is full of Hispanic students working from working-class families who are far below their grade level in terms of academic skills. Also have lots of social problems. Escalante seeks to change the school culture to help the students excel in academics. He soon realizes the untapped potential of his class and sees a goal of having the students take AP Calculus by their senior year. Starring Edward James Olmos, Estelle Harris, Virginia Paris, Cameron Argenziano, Rosanna DeSoto, Lou Diamond Phillips, Andy Garcia. We had a jobber in WCF named Blue Diamond Phillips.
I do remember.
Yes, I do that. Yes, I did. Anyway, that's actually one of the best movies of the year, that movie. I could watch that movie a lot. It's very good. And it is in the library, in the National Film Registry as well. So.
It took me a minute. I was thinking Estelle Getty, but Estelle Harris was... well, it was... what's her name? Estelle Costanza. No, what the hell? Was it Estelle Costanza? Why am I drawing a blank?
I can't remember the... I used to actually get Estelle Costanza. I used to get Estelle Costanza confused with Edie McClurg. Like, those actresses, even though they're, like, 25 years apart.
Right, right.
Like,
yes! Not even, they don't even look alike.
Yeah.
All right, so Estelle Costanza was in this, not Sophia Petrillo.
Not Sophia Petrillo, okay. So there were the three movies that came out the day before Friday, March 11th. All of them actually fairly memorable. All right.
Back again.
If you're not if this comment totally does not surprise you, this is a huge Rotella show that he watched on Hulu.
That's one of the few good things he likes.
Yeah. So.
Hey. If I did ever tell you, you would see that this kid would be me, and the card attached would
you say, failed AP history.
I could see Jaime Escalante hanging out in the condos.
So I used that in a best man speech. I ended reading the lyrics to that, and I had people all coming up to me. After asking, like I know that. What was it from? What is it? And I would tell them it's the Golden Girls theme song, and they were all freaking out. But it was the spoken word. It sounds very different than if you're not thinking about it.
Right.
As a purveyor of TV theme songs, that one is definitely a top 10.
Oh yeah.
For me,
it might be a top 10 show. I mean, it's a good.
Oh, one. It's definitely a top 10 show.
Yeah, it holds up real well. Yeah.
It holds up very well. I agree 100%. It's sad that Estelle Getty was. Described as the oldest of the bunch. In reality, A, she was the youngest, and B, she's the only one left. Well, Betty's the only one left. Yeah, yep. Betty's the only one left. Yeah. But it's funny, she was the youngest of the four, yet she was cast as the oldest of the four. So I always thought that was funny.
All right, give me a fuck, right. Mary, kill. Everyone but Sophia in that show.
I would kill Dorothy. I would fuck Blanche, and I would marry Rose, which seems pretty standard.
Yeah,
it is. Yeah.
Okay, easy one.
Yeah.
All right. What if I take Blanche out since she's the cougar and put Sophia in?
Oh, Jesus Christ!
I would still fuck Sophia.
Well, I think I'd fuck Rose. Betty White might be kind of crazy. Who knows? And Sophia would be a good one to marry, but Blanche, in the end, Dorothy's the one that's left with the dirt nap. So,
just so you know, even though that there was a writer's strike that started earlier in the week, there was an episode of The Golden Girls that aired on that night on the National Broadcasting Company. Rose's big adventure. Rose tries to light a fire under her newly retired boyfriend, who has become a couch potato, but she's not sure she wants to go along when he decides to sail around the world. Meanwhile, the lady's attempt to convert the garage into a guest room faces many obstacles. All right, that's a bad B story there. But
starring Peter Winston as Rose's boyfriend.
Pete Schermacher as Rose's boyfriend. She was about 2 stars.
Just make me some barbecue.
Give me
some of that St. Olaf brisket.
All right, so what if I take out Dorothy and put Richard Mulligan in?
All right, we're done. We got sports to do. All right, Richard Mulligan. Empty Nest. That's probably top 20. I wouldn't say top 10.
Well, it's a spinoff, anyway. Right? What was his name?
It's a spinoff. Yeah, it was a spinoff.
Yep.
Joey Suzu was in it, and what was her name? Christy McNichol, and who the hell was the other one?
What the fuck was Richard Mulligan's name on the show? Am I drawing a blank?
What's that?
An Empty Nest. Oh, Harry Weston. That's right.
Harry Weston.
I'm forgetting all my names tonight.
Yeah, Harry Weston. Yep.
He's not just, right. You know, he has a name. He's not just Joe Isuzu. It's doing a...
David Leisure. Yeah.
David Leisure.
Park Overall was also in that. It's a great
yes,
name.
Park Overall, Christy McNichol, and Dinah Manoff. Mm-hmm.
Did that have Jim J. Bullock in it?
No,
that was too close for comfort.
Oh, okay. I thought he was in something later in the 80s with David Leisure, but he's the dude that's lived the longest with AIDS. Like Magic Johnson is like, I can't get past this guy. Like Jim J. Bullock was diagnosed at 85, and he's still living.
Still
so good for
on.
Him.
All right, can you guys name anything else David Leisure was in?
He was in Airplane as one of the monks.
He was. He was in both Airplanes.
Yes. Yes, he was.
He was in Say Yes, You Can't Hurry Love, the Brady Bunch movie, so he did nothing for about 7 years. Nowhere, Hollywood Safari, looks like he did some animated stuff. 10 Things I Hate About You, Elvis Has Left the Building, 2004. Hmm. Last movie he was in was Dancing on a Dry Salt Lake, 2013. Benny.
Well, things will pick up.
His partner died of AIDS in 1996. In 1999, he was arrested outside a bar in West Hollywood for possession of crystal meth. Do you think he said it was AIDS-related medication?
Well, I shouldn't go there. Yes.
Anyway, there were four games in the NBA on this evening. The high scorer of the evening was Byron Scott, who had 35 for the Lakers, but they lost to Dallas 110 to 101. Your standings... At this point, the Celtics led the Atlantic at 43-19. The Pistons led the Central at 41-20. Mavericks led the Midwest at 41-19, and the Lakers led the Pacific at 49-12. Also, starting later that week, in fact, the next day, March 13th, was Selection Sunday for the 1988 NCAA basketball tournament. Of course, the defending champions are the Indiana Hoosiers. Teams that made it out of the Big East, let's see. Syracuse was a 3. The defending champions, Indiana, was a 4. Georgetown made it as an 8 in the East. URI made it in that year. I don't remember URI making it that year. BU made it. How about that?
Wow. Glad I was sitting down.
BU, Mr. Winston. Yeah. BU made it. You know who BU's coach was?
Guess.
A guy who would eventually destroy a Big East and D'Amato wants to kill him, but
Boeheim, Calhoun, good. I'll name them all. Chris Mullin,
Mike Jarvis.
Yeah. Oh right, yes. How could I forget?
Yeah. And you lost in the first round by 16 to Duke. So,
par for the course.
Par for the course. Pittsburgh made it in the Big East. DePaul wasn't in the Big East yet. Eastern Michigan, Oklahoma, Nova was a 6 in the Southeast. Big East had a good year that year. Anyway, your number one seeds were Temple, Purdue, Oklahoma, and Arizona. So we'll get more into the Big East tournament or get more in the NCAA tournament in 2 weeks because it'll be close to the Final Four at that time. And finally, as I as we talked earlier, in the NHL on this evening, there were 9 games, a busy night on the frozen pond. Kelly Nelson's Calgary Flames dropped 10 on Buffalo. 10. And you know who had a hat trick, Peter? One of the greatest names in the history of the NHL.
Håkan Lube
had a hat trick for the Flames. The Whalers were shut out 5-0 by Montreal. Mr. D'Amato's Rangers beat the Caps, who are playing right now, actually, 4-2. Let's see, the Blues were not playing. Okay. And the Bruins were in Quebec at Le Colisée, and they beat the Nordiques 4-3. Mr. Winston, 4 goals were scored by the Bruins. Ken Linsman had 1. This guy had a hat trick.
Okay. I don't think it was Cam Neely because they actually turned the roster over quite a bit because the Olympics had just gotten over and they brought in a lot of Canadian and U.S. Olympians. So I'm going to say Mr. Craig Janney.
The pride of Enfield High School, my friend, here in Connecticut.
Oh!
Is that right? Brother.
Allison Janney's brother.
Yes, so. Yes.
Yep. There you go. The standings at the moment, the Red Wings lead the Norris with 83 points. Flames lead the Smythe with 90. The Canadians lead the Adams by 6. The Bruins are in second with 84 points. And the Flyers lead the Patrick by 1 over
the Capitals. So, as we've talked enough about David Leisure and who's going to bang Sophia Petrillo, that is it for your pop culture report.
Okay. So Jesse Ventura is with Bobby Heenan and the Islanders backstage. Bobby's a beekeeper mask on and a dog collar with him. Jokes about being a big animal lover. Har har. That brings us to our next match, which is the Killer Bees battling the Islanders. Random tag match here to fill some time. Showcase the Islanders and Bobby in advance of Mania. Of course, having kidnapped or rumored to be kidnapping Matilda. Brunzell works over Tama to start and the Bees tag in and out to keep control. Jesse mocks the Bees' tights as Tama dodges a Brunzell dropkick and lands a headbutt. The Islanders punish Brunzell, picking up near falls until Brunzell escapes and takes a tag. Blair comes in hot, cleans house, goes to Hazel's Honey Hut, rolls up Tama, and gets the ref gets tied up with Brunzell. Haku levels Blair and covers and gets the win. I thought the finish was sloppy, and basically the ref was looking right at it as everything was going on. But fine enough tag match. You know, not a ton going on here, but good enough. And the Islanders stay hot heading into Mania. So I win a star and a half for this bad boy. Just a quick tag match to fill some time, Peter.
This apparently was originally a 2 out of 3 match, or was 2 out of 3 in the arena, but they only showed the first fall here, which...
only the first fall. Okay. Interesting.
Which, like, a little bit of Brian Blair goes a long way for me. I like the Islanders promo, not so much for Heenan in the beekeeper mask. That's a real creature of NBC to have him do that, but if you look at Haku the entire time, the smile on his face just had me cracking up. Like,
yes,
he basically has like Linus's smile from right. Peanuts, where it's like all kind of crooked and stuff. It's like, oh, it's Magnus. Don't tell Haku I said that, please. the Bees versus the Islanders makes me think it's the Bruins and the Islanders, except you know, not quite as good. But right. can somebody tell me what Brian Blair is good at here? Because everybody else in this match has like something that's like a plus quality. Like Tama is a terrific heel, mm-hmm. and it's a shame he didn't keep his head on straight. Haku is a total badass, as we know. Jim Brunzell was the inspiration for Kaz Okada with his dropkick. Like, they all have something. And honestly, I would rather watch Blair from Facts of Life, the great Lisa Wenchel, have her team up with Brunzell.
Hello, Blair.
And then Blair gets beat with a clothesline like it's a bad Survivor Series match from like the 90s. Like, oh, come on. I still give it 1 star because it was Blair who ate the pin.
Blair's good at doing coke, as we've heard on the Kevin Kelly show, based on the way he talks, delivers interviews. But he's good at going to the honey hut and getting the honey. I picture Scott as Mrs. Garrett's pool boy that she just takes advantage of, like in that time frame. Does that line up?
Girls,
breaking off a piece of some Joe Polnicek.
We're all good.
Oh, God. Yeah, I'm not as good as, George Clooney, the fucking fix-it man, all right?
This is Garrett's fuckboy, Scott Criscolo. Breaking down terrible. WrestleMania matches, well.
Terrible.
Making you go down on her.
Oh, God. Jesus. Where's Molly Ringwald? Anyway, I mean, this match was fine. Love the Islanders. I kind of dug the pre-match promo with Haku and the fucking barking. I thought that was really good.
More like Molly Ringwald for you.
What? Every senior citizen's pool boy? Thanks.
In 1980s you were. Not now.
Oh, no, well, yeah.
To be a pool boy now.
No. The Bees, this is the first time. It's funny you're talking about Blair, Peter, because the Killer Bees definitely seemed like a dated tag team. Now they seem like a team that's kind of, you know, not there anymore. Like they seem very 1986 and aren't with it. So the Islanders were the right team to put over here. You know, the Bobby jokes with the bee thing over his head and everything and making fun of the Bulldogs. That was really good. Bobby was in his prime right here. And nothing great here. Decent enough. I gave it a star and a half. I mean, nothing earth shattering. The right team went over. So pretty simple.
Okay.
And there from there.
Gene is with Slick and the One Man Gang. They talk about Slick shit talking the U.S. Olympic team. Slick doubles down, including crapping on Gene's kid, who was on the hockey team. I thought that was a nice touch. You know, they didn't talk much about Gene's kid being on the U.S. hockey team, so it was pretty funny here. Slick bring it up here. And that brings us to our final match of the evening, and that is the one-man gang taking on old Kenny Patera. It is a showcase for gang, you would think, but Patera's still hanging around, being used in these kinds of spots. Jesse talks about Steinbrenner, and he says he calls him Daddy Big Bucks, which which made me laugh. references him. Daddy Big Bucks. Maybe that's what you were calling Mrs. Garrett.
Oh, God.
Daddy Patera gets attacked by a gang as he disrobes and chokes him with his own pants. Patera fires back with some energy, actually hooks on a bear hug, shocking Vince and Jesse. Cool spot there is Patera showing off his power. Patera releases and gets to Phil Nelson as the gang is all out of sorts. Gang forces the break, and then Ken keeps bringing the heat. Gang turns a tide, uses his size to take control, and Patera comes back and shoots gang to the corner. Barry's knees and fists. Gang shrugs that off and hits a splash to nab the win. Patera fights Gang off after the bell, but before he can slam him, Slick pelts him with the cane. This is quick, but I thought it was fun for a power squash. Patera, I am coming around to Patera during this face run. He shows a lot of good energy. Like, he is nonstop in there, and he's just, you know, bounding all around the ring. Gang withstands it all and gets the win, but I kind of dug it. It was a low-key, fun little brawl. I win a star in that. And I will say that of all the daddies, as some will have you believe here at PlayStation.com, Daddy Jim Walsh from Beverly Hills, now 2-0, is the king of the daddies. So there you go.
Oh, of course. Mm-hmm. Never doubted that. Absolutely not. Although Mr. Drummond from Different Strokes, he really was Daddy. He was Big Daddy Big Bucks. Mm. So can't deny that. Incidentally, I should have mentioned in the Pop Culture Report, the 1988 Winter Olympics were happening in Calgary. The Soviet Union finished with the most medals, 29. They also had 11 golds. The U.S.
You think
they
sang the Soviet national anthem after?
Yes, they did.
Did they get the whole thing, you think?
Yeah, I think they did. The Cold War was quickly thawing, but they were still technically the United.
You don't
think
they got interrupted while they were singing the national anthem?
No, I don't think they were jumped by the British Bulldogs or Wyndham and Rotundo or whatever. So. And I could see why Slick was trashing our team, because it was not one of the U.S.'s best performances.
Do you think when Russia won the gold medal, they got up on the podium and they played this?
Yes, they all danced on the podium. They're doing like the pokey. Yes, they finished with 29 golds. 29 medals total, 11 golds. The U.S. finished 2 golds, 1 silver, and 3 bronze. Only 6 medals, which was not great. So Slick, almost as much as I hate seeing our country made fun of, they kind of had a point. Anyway. I think let me see who won hockey. I'm sure the Soviets did.
They did.
Yeah, I think
U.S. finished seventh. They actually had a seventh place game and they beat Switzerland. I don't know why they even bother.
Yeah, that's
how sad it must be to play in the seventh place game. Like, why? Like, do you have any energy to go out there and play that game?
Actually, you want to know what's worse? There was an 11th place game.
Oh my God!
Yep.
France beat Norway in a shootout. Wow! Wow, they really put a lot of energy into that one. Here's your bowl. You know. But yes, the gold medal. The gold medal game was. What was the gold medal game? Soviets must have played Finland.
They might have been playing like a weird round robin then, too, like they did in the 80s, when like the U.S. could have been bronze or gold with the last game.
But the Soviets won the gold. Finland won the silver, and Sweden, who have those awesome three-crown jerseys. I love Sweden's uniform.
Ludwig Borga was at the Finnish silver medal game.
Signing autographs.
The heel environmentalist.
he was there to make sure that all the cans were recycled during the game.
That is so funny.
We should recycle those medals.
Yeah.
All right. So anyway, that was the 88 Winter Olympics. U.S. did not do great. But we'll be in Seoul this summer. So when we get to those, when we get into July and August, we'll get more into the Olympics as we head to Seoul, South Korea for the Summer Games. All right, JR, good.
I went. It's your turn. Talk about the match.
Yeah. Let's talk more about the Olympics. No. Yeah. I have to say, I agree with you about Patera, but I mean, I understand he had an arm injury, but what the fuck was this bionic thing he had on his arm? And he was hitting people with it, and nobody was saying anything.
Like Jose Canseco in the fucking batter's box with that thing on.
I know, like,
it had body armor.
But it had, like, exposed metal and everything. Like, how does nobody say anything? You know, it's, like, crazy. But he was actually busting his butt. I got to give Patera that. He was actually working pretty hard. So I was pretty impressed with that. But the gang, I think continuing the narrative on how this tournament at WrestleMania 4 is wide open. These big dudes are going to make an impact. I mean, obviously Andre is a heavy favorite, but you got to give the gang his due. He's a big guy. He crushed Patera in this match. And I think that was the key. I think that was basically the narrative of the show, was to showcase the fact that anybody could win this tournament for the first time. Again, for the first time in the history of the WWF, I'll say, obviously, the world title is vacant. And that's a big deal. I mean, vacant? You know, that's never happened. And so wrestling fans at this point are like, it's weird not having a world champion. It's bizarre. I mean, I remember still being unnerved not seeing Hogan with it around his waist. So as a fan at the time, you're really, like, feeling weird about this. Like, what's going on? I mean, yeah, obviously, as we were saying, you know, Hogan probably was the favorite because he's the favorite at everything at this point. But, I mean, it's crazy. All these other guys like Savage and DiBiase and even One Man Gang, you know, all of them are stating their case that they should be the favorite, Peter. So even if the match, you know, on the surface is just a throwaway, I think in the long run, it made a big impact on how this tournament was going to be taken seriously.
Yeah, I mean, you got to have the guy who's in the tournament go over here instead of the guy who literally has nothing going on. I was wondering what Rosero's thoughts were on Jesse Ventura as a Yankee. Was he a true Yankee, or was he one of the phony baloney ones like Gary Sheffield?
No, he's a true Yankee. I mean, at least until he went off the deep end in the mid-2000s. But in his prime, he was a true Yankee for sure. Anyone who can call Big Stein Daddy Big Bucks is a true Yankee.
You got to love how Patera had, like, the jobberiest entrance ever with his crappy-looking arm brace that's skin-colored, too. So, yeah, he is clearly trying to hide it from them, although I would have chosen blue or red or, you know, something that would go from his gear. And so, like, right, you know, he goes into the medical supply store. Yeah, give me beige, please. Yes. Yeah,
give me a Spanx for my arm, basically, is what I wanted.
Yeah. Now, I like the pants choking spot. That was great. Choking him with the very pants he was returning. Yes. the bear hug spot was interesting, I thought. I mean, you usually don't see a 460-pound guy put in a bear hug. And but once again, I get distracted. That damn table is still at ringside, and it's somehow back together. They've now either repaired it or we've traveled back in time somehow through a time warp. But another clothesline finish, I didn't care for that. But Vince is a little in love with the phrase "Lady Luck" riding on his shoulders, because he used that for Andre at the main event last month. And now he's using it for Gang. It's kind of like Gorilla with irresistible force and a movable object, but like using it for the Warlord instead of Andre Hogan later on. I've listened to what you've had to say with Patera, and maybe he's not that bad, but I can't get over the damn hair. I'm sorry. He looks too much like Richard Simmons. To the point where I was gonna give it 1.5, but I'm only gonna give it 1 because Patera's hair just bothers me. They needed to do a haircut angle with him stat.
Yeah, you wonder if he would have done anything more if he had better hair.
Or no hair.
I'd give it a 1 too.
Shave it. Yeah. Nobody was bald back
better
then.
Hair, no hair, whatever. And then maybe even just maybe a little better tights because of the way his legs were. Like, man.
Oh.
Maybe like
so
the ones
creamy.
That come down a little bit like his shorts, you know what I mean? Versus the
yeah,
straight
something.
Crotch,
anything.
Nut huggers.
Yes.
I gave it. By the way, I gave it a star as well. So,
Okay, very good.
And that's it, right? Oh, we get, do we do our outs?
Yeah, well, Gene talks to Hogan, who's chuckling and kind of acting crazy as he talks about his hit list. So he's kind of being nuts headed into WrestleMania. And then Jesse and Vince wrap up the show. So yeah, that does bring us to the end. And that means, gentlemen, it brings us to our awards for this evening. And we will begin with our match of the night. I went with... Oh, I had two checking at 3 stars, but I went with Hogan Harley. I liked it slightly more than Savage DiBiase. I thought I loved, like, and just knowing what Harley, like you were saying earlier, Scott, what Harley went through with that table bump, and or Peter, whoever one of you said it, but what he did with that table bump and just kept fucking going was like super impressive to me. And I loved the story the match told with Hogan being aggressive, had a good finish. So yeah, that was my favorite match of the night.
They were both awesome, but for me, I got to give the edge to Savage DiBiase. I mean, they went at just an incredible pace and really fired up the crowd and gave you an inkling of maybe what was to come. Hogan Harley was fantastic, but I'm going to give a slight edge to the Savage DiBiase match.
Yeah, this was a tough one, but I did give the Hogan Harley one a 2.5, but Savage Ted, I gave 3, so I got to go with that for match of the night.
All right, let's do the Cousin Junior for the worst match of the evening. And again, you know, this is, on Saturday's main events, that's always tough because the worst match usually isn't one that deserves or earns worst match status. It's usually just kind of the throwaway junk match at the end of the night. And that's what I went with here, Gang Patera. But even that wasn't, I mean, it wasn't bad. Like if we had that on an MSG show, we'd probably be in the top half of the matches for the evening. But on this card, it was no chance.
No, I agree. It was, I mean, 1 star for me.
So, if that was on an MSG show and ran only three minutes and 47 seconds, you would be on your hands and knees thanking God that the agent cut it short to give somebody else more time, like an Omar Atlas or, you know, somebody more deserving.
God, wait till you get to the April 88 show, by the way. Sky, I watched a huge chunk of that last night, and it is, talk about long, drawn-out matches. Just be ready.
Oh, Jesus. Oh, my God.
Yeah, Patera Gang
All right, the Hogan Award for the MVP of the evening. Shocker, shocker. I went with Andre the Giant yet again. I loved his presence during that match. Everything about him just screams like biggest star, even more than Hogan for me at times. I thought he was fantastic in his role during the Savage DiBiase match, and just a well-earned and well-deserved spot for him.
Yeah, I mean, he was all over the place. I concur.
I am going to give the MVP to Harley Race just as a tip of the cap for the way he gutted through that match and no-sold a hernia, literally.
Insane.
Yeah.
All right. Our Uncle Elmer Award for the worst wrestler of the evening. You look at this on paper and you're thinking, oh, probably going to be Patera, but I went with Brutus Beefcake. I did not think he was very good in that opening match. And knowing where he's heading in the next few weeks... is an intercontinental title challenger for Honky Tonk Man, I thought was I was expecting more out of him, and the finish was stupid, and Valentine really walked him through this one. So I really thought he was the worst of the evening. And if Patera Gang had a little more time, it may have surpassed Brutus Valentine for me.
Yeah, it was upsetting in that aspect, and the ending doesn't help. It doesn't do him any favors either. So yeah, I have to concur with that.
Well, I like Beefcake too much as a, you know, he is a noted Boston Bruins fan, you know. Mm-hmm. I saw him multiple times at the 09 playoffs.
He also had blow in the in the subways or whatever.
Well, who among us hasn't carried that on the orange
line
at
one point?
Right. Yeah, I'm going to have to go with Brian Blair.
Of course, Brian Blair.
Sucks balls. I already wrote it in.
Yep. Yeah. I'd already written it in the category here.
Pre-populate, yep.
Okay. One sec, sorry. All right. So our best moment of the night, I went with Andre Salting Savage. I thought that was my highlight of the evening.
Yep. It was very impressive. Andre, once again, just – I know you're saying, JR, that he does eventually settle in, but he still just has that presence.
Oh, I got to go with Harley going through the table.
Yeah.
I mean, that's something that'll live, you know, abs forever. So I mean, that's one of the most memorable spots on a Saturday Night's main event, and I'm going to give a double tip of the cap to Harley again.
Poor Harley.
So
tough night.
That's the moment right there.
All right, the Morocco Award for the most juiced up. I gave this one to Hogan. I thought he was above everyone else on this show.
Oh, yeah, there was nobody close. Yeah. Morocco wasn't there. I mean, Virgil was looking pretty big,
yeah,
but not like Hogan.
Yeah, it's got to be Hogan. I love 88 Hogan. You know, this is when I started watching, and Hogan was my hero, so.
I thought you were going to say Harley. You've given everything to Harley. I thought you were going to say Harley was the most juiced.
Oh, he wasn't the most juiced because after his hernia, it would have just come flying
right,
out.
Right, I say
like,
yeah, the juice.
Like a cartoon
kid. He was leaking the most juice.
Other juice would have come out, just not as pleasant.
The other juice was Mrs. Garrett when Poolboy Scott came around. But I am enjoying 88 for the Morocco Award. So starting with Saturday Night's Main Event in January, Hogan, Royal Rumble, Hogan and Morocco tied. House show January 88, Morocco. Hogan at main event, Morocco. So it goes Hogan, Hogan and Morocco. Morocco, Hogan, Morocco, Hogan so far for the most juice. So we'll see come WrestleMania 4. The Patera Award for Worst Hair, which we started, Tim Slomka instituted this last show. It's the February 88. I give it to Ken Patera here.
Yep. Yes, it has to be. Yeah. And anybody who would vote for, say, Greg Valentine for worst hair, we can't be friends.
Yeah, exactly.
It'll be this one will get interesting when Patera leaves or he's not around. So that's when it'll start getting some. But until then, it's Patera's to lose. All right, overall grade on this evening, gentlemen. I went 6.5. I thought this was a really strong Saturday Night's Main Event. I had a 3.5 back in January, so almost double that one. So I really think we get off to a strong start, and I think this is the best one since October, which was like a really great one that we covered. So I enjoyed this show quite a bit. I thought there was a lot going on. It was a nice precursor to 4, and you get the two really big anchor matches and nothing real bad. So what do you got, Scott?
I will 100% agree with you. I also take 6.5. Mm-hmm. The last two matches were just there to fill, but again, even though the Gang Patera match was had a little bit of intrigue in terms of, you know, making Gang a legit guy, and really we're tightening up the narrative about the tournament and who the favorite could be and who could walk away with it, if not Hogan, but obviously Hogan was the guy that everybody had on their minds. But well booked. Savage looked great. Harley, well, Peter, I'll let you talk about Harley. Everybody else was utterly tremendous. So 6.5 for me.
Yeah, I'm going the full 7. Harley gives the extra half point up to a 7, I think. and I think the show was perfectly paced. You get the, you know, you get led in with the Beefcake Valentine and how that feud is older, and then you have the two big matches at the 2 and the 3 spot. And anything offensive at the back end, it was not too long. It was maximum 4 minutes. And of course, as usual, the promos are generally really good on these shows, entertaining. So I'll go full 7 out of 10.
Okay. All right. There we go.
That'll do it. Puts a bow on it. All right. So next week we will be back. And joining us will be the triumvirate of John D'Amato, Kelly Nelson, Pete Schermarker. We'll be doing another build like we did for WrestleMania 3. Kind of did a lead-up show. So this will be our WrestleMania 4 preview show. We'll be talking some past tournaments in WWF history leading up to that point, and also some of the possible rebooking for the WrestleMania 4 tournament. And we're going to dive into the original brackets as well as to maybe where they would have been headed. So check that out. And then we're off on the 11th, Scott. We'll be back on June 18th with WrestleMania 4. So that's our two next installments. Anything you got going on this week?
This week, Mr. Milton and I, the Godfather, will be doing the next installment of our series, counting down our top 100 greatest WWE superstars of all time. So stay tuned for that. What do you have this week, sir?
Well, last week we had a brand new Wrestling War Zone, Monday Night Wars, mm-hmm. looking at a Raw and a Nitro. Of course, that show doing well. I want to thank everyone who listens and sends us your feedback and notes. You can like our Facebook page, just search Wrestling War Zone, and it'll come right up, and that's on the Place of the Nation Wrestling feed. So I'm having a blast with that. Chad and I go through all the WCW WWF pay-per-views of Raws and Nitro starting with September 11th, 95 is where we kicked off. So the first official week of the war. So it's been a lot of fun deep diving into those. Also, after a little hiatus, Jeff Lerner's Wrestling returned. So we looked at WrestleMania 4, Scott. So it was good timing as to what we have coming up. It was a good look at that. Jeff opened up on his personal life, too, which has a lot of dramatic moments going on at this point. So mm-hmm. we spent the first half hour talking about that, as well as Breaking Bad, which I've been watching. So we dove into that stuff, and then the rest of the show is WrestleMania 4. So it was good to be back with Jeff, hoping to get back on a routine there. And then we'll have a new Wrestling War Zone coming this week as well, so check that out. on the PlayStation Wrestling feed. Mr. Winston, what do you have?
When I was listening to Jeff Lawrence Wrestling, you guys were talking about like the health kick that you were on.
Yes.
And I'm thinking everybody at Place to Be Nation seems to be on some sort of diet or whatever. I'm going in the opposite direction. I've doubled down on my drinking. So of course today I feel, you know, woozy as hell, and I was drinking green tea while recording this podcast. So whatever. Greetings from Allentown. This Thursday on the Pro Wrestling Only feed, I'm going back to Mini. Yes, the AWA again. And yeah, I explain why I do that by conducting an interview with myself where I talk in a very weird accent. I don't know why I did that. So it's May 9th, 1987, right after Super Clash 2 and the controversy with Nick Bockwinkel and Kurt Hennig, and trying to figure out how on this ESPN show Super Ninja was allowed on camera wearing a fucking swastika on his arm. Yes.
I know. That's crazy.
I tweeted it out earlier, and I couldn't believe it when I saw it. I was like, oh my God. But, you know, there were some very fine people in the AWA as well. So, I'll say that. That joke might be a little dated, but...
I like it. And if nothing else, just remember the one takeaway from tonight, and that is Scott the pool boy. Miss Garrett walks in and says, I'm married, Scott. Can someone please do me? And Scott says, I like you, Miss Garrett. I'm going to go ahead and take care of business.
I know where you got that from.
You got to watch what you favorite on Twitter, my friend.
I thought it was funny.
Anyway, that'll do it. We'll be back next week. Place to Be podcast. Peter Winston, thank you. As always, we'll look to have you back soon as well. Other than that, everyone take care. Check out all the feeds, Place to Be Nation Wrestling, Place to Be Nation Pop, Pro Wrestling Only, and like us on Facebook, on Twitter, and all the stuff. So until then, Scott, Peter, I'm Justin. We're out. Talk to you in a week. Bye.
Oh, Scotty. Molly Ringwald.